Hello and welcome to this episode of Ear Movies. I'll be honest with you, I'm not a feelings, trust your gut kind of guy. I'm more practical, observant, I guess. I try to build on logic. But I'd be lying to you if I didn't say I had a feeling Anne-Louise Lambert was going to be perfect for Still Life. I haven't seen anything she's been in for a while, but she always had a softness and sensitivity and strength when I used to watch her on the screen. Now, as an older actor, what she does has become more refined and somehow even more powerful. I loved her reading of this quirky story about life on the land, and I hope you do too.
Still Life. Thank God the summer was over, but it still hadn't rained. The earth was brown talc. The grass had been buzz-cut by grazing. It was pale yellow flakes on the dust. It was sepia confetti. It was a memory of the land's divorce from water, and it stank of despair. Pete had been hand-feeding for over a year. He'd had to choose which animals to sell and which to keep for breeding once the rains came, if they came. The more animals you kept, the more it cost to feed them. The more you sold, the less you got for them, because everyone else was selling theirs too. And the fewer you had to restock with, of course. Pete had been on the land all his life, so he'd kept a sensible amount of hay and savings in reserve, but the cattle had literally eaten into both. He'd take off his hat and inspect the brim as if a couple of decades worth of fly shit could tell him anything new. Who'd be a bloody farmer, he'd say. At first he said it with a smile, but as the drought went on, he didn't smile so much. Worst one in 100 years, he said. I'd been born and raised on the North Shore, upper class Sydney. To me, everything in the bush felt like it was the worst. We'd already had the worst floods, the worst mouse plague, and the worst fires. I'd long ago decided that everything that had been and was to come would also be the worst. You'd only remember what you were experiencing and forget what had been. I suffered through each new disaster. Pete just muttered, "Who'd be a bloody farmer?" then just soldiered on. I'd think back to the day our worlds collided at the Easter show, in line for the roller coaster. Both my girlfriend and his had piked at getting on. That left us sitting next to each other on the ride. Without thinking, I held his hand. I felt tingling when I touched his skin. He noticed it too. Suddenly, we were looping the loop. 23 years and 3 kids later, we still were. It was Shelby who noticed them first. Maybe that wasn't a surprise. He was good like that. Special, you'd say. But in a clever way, he noticed patterns was how I saw it. Things would drive him mad if they weren't organized the way he liked. He had books, and he kept the authors in alphabetical order. Dale was arty, a bit like me, I thought. He organized his books by color, for what it's worth. Shelby was good on fencing because he'd keep the posts in a straight line and exactly the same distance apart. He plowed with precision, even before we bought a GPS. "Has anyone else noticed Prince and Charlotte?" he asked. Prince was Pete's old horse, which he still used for mustering. Charlotte was the cow we kept for milking. "What about them?" Sue asked. Sue was between Shelby and Dale, 5 years apart to both. She wasn't interested in either books or order. She liked footy and cricket, and whenever she could, was out on her push bike with the town kids. Pete said she was the white sheep of the family. Today she was playing a Game Boy on the lounge. "The horse and the cow, I think they're in love," Shelby said. I admit I smiled when I heard that. It was such a Shelby thing to say. But Shelby noticed stuff. I went to the window. Prince was on one side of the three-strand wire fence that separated the home paddock from the one behind the house. Sure enough, despite the barrier between them, Charlotte was alongside him. "They're just next to each other," I said. "It doesn't prove anything." "They've been there for an hour," Shelby said. I watched for a while longer. At one point, their heads nodded in unison, just like they were talking and had said something they both agreed with. "See," Shelby said. "It doesn't prove anything," I said.
"It proves Shelby's a dipshit," Sue said.
"Don't be rude to your brother," I replied automatically. Then I saw Charlotte bend down and take a mouthful of loosened hay off the ground where Pete had thrown it. The loosened was the good stuff we gave her to keep her milk in longer. She leaned over and dropped some at Prince's feet. Prince didn't waste any time in eating it. But then the most amazing thing. He and Charlotte touched noses. You'd swear they were kissing. By now Dale had joined us. "I think he's right, Mum," he said.
"Dale's a dipshit too," Sue said.
"Go to your room, Sue," I said, not for the first time. Now Shell had alerted me to it, I kept an eye on Prince and Charlotte. They did seem to spend a lot of time together. Charlotte was alone in the home paddock, but Prince had other horses in his. If he was with her, it wasn't due to him craving the company of another animal. Pete scoffed when I mentioned it to him. He was Sue-like in that regard, I thought. One afternoon, I opened the gate for Prince. He wasted no time in heading straight for Charlotte. Once again, that mutual gesture which looked like they were kissing. But he was a horse and she was a cow. He was also a gelding. Not that it mattered, I guess. But that line from Fiddler on the Roof kept coming to mind. A bird may love a fish, but where would they build a house together? Well, in our home paddock, it seemed. Pete rolled his eyes when I mentioned it to him again, and I decided not to say anything else. Not unless I had proof, anyway. After the holidays, Sue and Dale went back to school, catching the bus out the front of our property every morning. Shell did stock work and helped Pete with the feeding. I did housework and errands all morning. I didn't mind being a woman caring for her family, but it wasn't my only identity. After lunch, I'd rummage around the bottom of my undies drawer to dig out the draft of the novel I'd started years earlier. At uni, I'd been known as a good essayist. I'd been on my way to a career in writing until Pete and the roller coaster arrived. Mum never forgave me. Said I'd wasted my life. I'd been too busy on the land to think much about it, but one afternoon, I'd taken one of Shell's old exercise books up the road to the Memorial Park. We were in the middle of nowhere, really, but so was this monument to the blokes from the district who'd served. The council had made a bit of an effort a few years back and put up a new fence, planted some trees, and added some stuff for the kids. A slippery dip, swings, and one of those merry-go-rounds you push before hopping on. None of the equipment would make it past a health and safety inspection these days. But then, not many kids use them anymore either, so I think the council had forgotten about them. Not me, though. I went up there in the afternoons, unless it was raining. This meant I'd been there every day for over 18 months straight. There was a reason I went there. This weird thing happened to me on the merry-go-round. If I spun it anti-clockwise at just the right speed, it wouldn't stop turning. It was bizarre. I could sit on it for bloody hours and watch the world slowly revolve around me. It wouldn't happen if I spun clockwise. It wouldn't happen if I did it too fast or too slow. But when I got the speed and the direction right, it just wouldn't stop. Magnetism of some kind, maybe? I don't know. The wind? It'd happen even if it was still. And if I was sitting on it, and it was turning slowly round like a windmill that had fallen on its back, well, it was the most relaxing thing you can imagine. Like it put me in some kind of trance. Truth to tell, I was practically addicted to it. I'd lie back and watch the sky spinning over me and... Look, I'm not a religious, go-to-church-on-a-Sunday kind of person, but somehow being on it felt like I was near to God. Whatever God is. After a while, I'd open the exercise book and write. Only ever one sentence, though. Just one sentence a day. That was the rule I had. A single line to add to the story. But all stories are like that, aren't they? One line at a time. Mine was just written more slowly than most. Not that it mattered. When it was finished, you'd be able to read it at whatever speed you liked, like an old record player, 33 or 45 or 78, or pick an RPM of your own. I'd head home when I heard the bus. It'd mean Sue and Dale and, when he was younger, Shelby, were coming home. Then there'd be hungry mouths to feed and stories of their day to be heard and trips to sport fields to make. The merry-go-round would be still when I'd visit it the next day. I never knew how long it took after I left for it to stop turning. I like to think it just gradually slowed as I walked away. I think that's how it must have been. Not just because it wouldn't be turning when I went up the next day, but also because I knew I'd take some of its momentum with me. It buoyed me through the rest of the day, the kids arguing, Pete's worries and concerns, the rest of the jobs I needed to do. Sometimes, in bed, with Pete snoring gently beside me, stuffed after a hard day fighting the elements, I'd hear it still turning. If I listened carefully enough, there'd be the sound of metal softly rubbing against metal. Slower and slower. It was pleasing in its way, as if it was somehow waiting for me, and I'd go to sleep to the music of it. Shelby was 19. He liked spending time by himself, but I knew he was lonely as well. He'd never had a girlfriend. He'd had girls who were friends, and he'd been smitten by Cindy Sheargold for a while, but then pretty much all of the boys in town had been smitten by Cindy at one time or another. I liked that she and Shelby had been friends, though. She'd dated a couple of other boys, but she'd demonstrated a genuine affection for Shel. Not the kind that would blossom into romance, that was true. But to me it showed what a nice kid Shel was when even a girl like Cindy, who had her pick, would choose to spend time with him. I don't think Shel ever saw it as more than a friendship, but I pined for the day, as I know he did, when the right girl would come along. It was Dale who claimed to have found a solution. About a year earlier, one of the neighbour's dogs had had puppies. Dale had begged us for yonks to have a pet. We'd given him one as a house dog. We had Kelpies as working dogs, but this was a Labrador. One night, Dale made an announcement. "She's a bride dog now," he said. "You mean guide dog, dumbass," Sue told her. "Language, Sue," I said automatically. "But yes, Dale, you mean guide dog." "Uh-uh," Dale said. "I've been training her. If they can teach dogs to help the blind or sniff out drugs or illnesses or explosives, why can't they identify the person you're meant to marry?" This explained his obsession with watching romances and reality dating shows with the dog beside him, I thought. Every time we saw a couple fall in love, I'd give the dog a treat, he said. It can recognize soulmates now, I swear. I looked down at the dog. It looked back at me with long-nosed disdain. Also, Shelby needs all the help he can get, Dale said. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, Sue said. Dale said, there's no dog in the world smart enough to find someone for you, Sue. The dog, which we now call Bridie, was initially unsuccessful. Shelby took her with him everywhere. Obviously, she was never going to do much on our property. But in town, she had the opportunity to sniff around the ankles of the women Shelby walked past. In some ways, I suppose it was a little invasive, in that the women didn't know they were being invisibly assessed against who knew what criteria. I wondered what would happen if Bridie identified the right candidate. We knew she had been trained, like other sniffer dogs, to bark politely and wait for a treat once she'd located her target. It wasn't like she'd go rabid. But what did Shelby do then? How would he respond to the fact that the woman with the dog crouched before her would apparently be happy to spend the rest of her life with him? What if she was already married? Or too young? Or if there was anything else that stopped him from proposing to her? Was there only one person for him? If there was more than one, what did that say for the concept of soulmates? Pete joked that he'd take Bridie out one day to find someone to replace me. It wasn't funny. Admittedly, he was under a lot of pressure at the time. That night, though, as I lay in bed, I wondered what would happen if I took Bridie for a walk. Would she select Pete? What if she found someone else? I brushed the thought away. There are some places you shouldn't visit. In the meantime, there was the issue of the other romance on our property to consider. Prince and Charlotte were still spending most of their time together. When I'd go up in the mornings to bring Charlotte inside our little cow shed to milk, Prince would follow forlornly. He knew separation was coming, even if it was only for a little while. He'd stand outside the bales with his head down. Then, when Charlotte was released back into the paddock, his tail would flick and he'd appear happy again as they moved off once more, side by side. Their favourite spot was by the trees near Pete's collection of rusty farm machinery. I wasn't worried about Prince and Charlotte, but I worried that I should be worried. It was pretty strange. And why had this apparent reversal of the natural order taken place here, on our property? Did it have anything to do with the merry-go-round? Under the peppercorns, it was so dry. The grass didn't grow there at all. When Prince stamped his hooves, dust rose. Did they know something we didn't, I wondered. Were they acclimatizing for the world that was to come for all of us? Were we all going to become used to walking in clouds of dirt forever? Certainly from the look on Pete's face when he came in at night, you'd think it was our only option. It can't have been easy to look at the soil moisture reader to see yet again that there was no hope. What was land if you couldn't plant on it? If you couldn't plant on it, you couldn't run stock on it. In that way, it was a factory with no raw materials. All the equipment was there, the workforce was there, but you couldn't make anything. I'd look down from the merry-go-round at the farm. Our home, spinning slowly into sight and then vanishing again. I could see so much of it from up there. Only one side was obscured by the stand of memorially planted silver gums on the edge of the little park. The farm would come into view again and again as I orbited. Under yellowing afternoon skies, I saw no chance of redemption. Like us, the sky was waiting for rain. Also like us, it was powerless to bring it. A sky like that has no purpose, I thought. I would look at it as I orbited slowly beneath it. I knew Pete watched it as well, with equally concerned eyes. I had married a man, and he hated the sky. I wrote that down in my book. One afternoon, I saw Prince give Charlotte a flower. The home paddock had a windmill, one of those old Southern Cross ones, a cranky, rusty thing that turned slower than my merry-go-round. It had pumped from the aquifer below us, which Pete knew, like our other bores, was nearly empty. But after the animals had watered at the trough it fed, the ground would become momentarily damp. Somehow a dandelion had taken hold in the only piece of dirt on the whole farm that was fertile, and I watched in amazement as one day Prince delicately plucked the yellow flower and dropped it in front of Charlotte. She'd lowered her head, and they'd rubbed necks together. I thought of how hostile the world looked for them. A place with a single flower. Tiny patch of green in the landscape of straw and dust. They were used to the feeling of blown dirt in their eyes, of the ground hard underfoot where once they'd known soft grass. They were used to straw and not the sweetness of fresh pasture. We were all becoming immune to rain. I became scared about the immortality of the drought. I thought of the stories of Dis. It had a similar landscape to ours. In Dis, you were thirsty all the time. In Dis, the ground was hard. It sprouted only thorns and burrs. In Dis, there was a farm with no water. It was our farm. When I drove into town, it was common to hear our neighbours were planning to sell, or the bank was about to foreclose. Nothing ever happened, though. How can you sell when there are no buyers? How can you foreclose when something is worthless? In this way, eternity dragged on for another day. And another day after that. Strangely enough, it was Sue who noticed when Prince and Charlotte parted ways. Not that she put it particularly sensitively. "The dumb horse has gone off the stupid cow," she said. She appeared to be right. While the two animals had previously been inseparable, now they stood at either end of the paddock, completely ignoring each other. When I led Prince into the back paddock later, he cantered off without looking back, heading straight for the other horses. A trail of dust followed. It hung in the air for most of the morning, like a signpost. Only to what, I didn't know. Early in the afternoon, though, a Volkswagen Beetle lurched up the driveway. Not one of the modern ones, but the old duck-duck-duck kind. I was about to go for my walk to the park, but I hung back, not recognizing either the car nor driver. Around here, you pretty much know everyone. A woman got out. After rummaging around in the back seat, she emerged with a small artist's canvas, an easel and a bag. I guess it contained stuff for painting. She was young. I'd let Shelby handle this, I thought. The other two kids were at school. Pete was down the back of the property looking for strays, so apart from Shelby, I was the only one to see her arrive. Bridie had a quick sniff of her ankles and was instantly disinterested. Strangely enough, that told me all I wanted to know. I filled my water bottle, half wondering, as I always did these days, whether I'd turn on the tap to see only dust coming out. I waited until Shelby had met the woman on the front veranda, then headed out the back door. I ducked round the house, down the driveway, and up the hill. The faded white VW was visible from the lookout. I spun up the merry-go-round and wondered how many revolutions it'd take for the car to disappear. The world turned slowly around me. I wrote my sentence. I shut my eyes. When I woke up sometime later, I was, of course, still spinning. The Beetle was still in the driveway. I knew the bus would be along soon. Back home, I found Shelby sitting in the kitchen. The driver of the V-Dub was there too. "This is Ronnie," he said. "Hello," I said. "She's an artist," he said. "She's going to paint some pictures." "Portraits?" "Landscapes," Ronnie said. "I've been going from farm to farm trying to sell my art. Shelby's the first person to commission me." "He's going to pay you?" I asked. He nodded. "It's okay, it'll come out of my savings," he said. The kids'd be in the door at any moment. "It's your money," I said. And then turned to Ronnie. "I can't think where you'll find artistic inspiration around here just now," I told her, "unless you like painting dust." She surprised me by smiling. "It's okay," she said. "I paint the future. It's not always going to look like this." Before I could ask what she meant, Dale and Susie burst through the door and I had to deal with dropped school bags, demands for food and drink, and questions about who Ronnie was. I made sandwiches and left the explanations to Shelby. He seemed smitten with Ronnie, couldn't take his eyes off her. Bridie was curled up in her bed in the corner, completely disinterested. One of them's in for a shock, I thought. Ronnie became a regular visitor. Pete took to her instantly, and that's always a good measure of a person, in my opinion. We had our chats as well. Ronnie was happy to talk about anything. Shelby had set up the barn as an impromptu studio. We thought of it as their space. Pete and I never intruded. "She's really great," Shelby told me for the 100th time as we watched the Beetle once again trundle away down our rough driveway. "When are we going to see some art?" I asked. "She's doing it," he said. "She'll show you when it's done." "Is she, you know, doing what she said?" I asked. "She reckons she could paint the future." "Well, she says she is," he replied. "But how can I tell if she's right? It hasn't happened yet." "Well, I'm looking forward to seeing her work. Don't pay her until after she's finished, though, hey, Shell?" I said. I mean, I was looking after him, wasn't I? Last thing we needed was some kind of con artist who'd take his money, break his heart, and move on. "She said you'd be able to see them soon," he told me. "But not yet, though. For one thing, she's run out of green." If Ronnie really was an artist who painted the future of our place and she needed more green in the middle of a drought, then I took that as a good sign. In my memory, it was only the next afternoon that we saw something that gave us, for the first time in over a year, hope. It was only one cloud in the distance. Of course, there'd been many clouds, but not like this one. It was tall, grey at the base, tending to alabaster up top. A storm cloud, if ever there was one. For the moment, it sat alone on the horizon. They only travel in packs, clouds like that. Somewhere we couldn't see, its friends were waiting. I held Pete's hand as we gazed at it that evening from the veranda. He wasn't the kind of bloke to get his hopes up. But I felt the tingle of our skin touching. The next day I wrote, "A cloud tending to alabaster," in my exercise book. Under it I put, "We watched it, our skin tingling, our hands never lied." I sat on the merry-go-round watching our dry farm reappear with every revolution. The cloud sat in the distance. I prayed for it to approach. I longed for Ronnie to find more green paint, for Bridie to recognize her as Shelby's wife, for the smell of rain on the soil, for the tingle of Pete's hands on my back. Ronnie appeared not to mind working in our barn. You know what those sheds are like? Held up by rust and cobwebs mainly, with a floor of dried mouse shit. Shelby had done his best to clean it out. He'd started to fix the broken window, but apparently she'd told him to leave it. She wanted the light and the air, she said. Shelby had tried to entice Bridie to stay with him while Ronnie painted, but she wouldn't go near the barn. He even put her bowl down there as if he was trying to bribe the dog into making Ronnie his wife. He spent all his free time with Ronnie. Pete and I spoke about it. We weren't sure how much to trust the dog, to be honest. Did we try and keep Shell away from Ronnie so his heart wouldn't be broken down the track? Or should we give him free rein and the chance to hook up with her and choose his own path independent of canine intuition? I didn't know whether Ronnie was the one for him, but I couldn't fault her on her work ethic. She painted diligently from 9 until 3 most days. In the end, we let Shell decide how much time he spent with her, which was usually from after lunch until she finished for the day. He'd watch her drive away with what I called his sad look. He'd recover pretty quickly, though, and get on with his work. "Are you going to ask her out?" I wanted to know. "Already have," he said. "And?" I asked. He shook his head. "Not yet," he said. "She wants to finish the project. Then she said she'd see." Bridie put up her head and looked across at us, and then glanced away again to where a bird was scratching in the dirt. She put her head back down and closed her eyes. "Sounds like Ronnie is being sensible," I said. It was Shelby's turn to watch the bird, but it was having none of it and flew away the moment his eyes fell on it. "What's in her paintings?" I asked. "What does she think is going to happen?" I realized I'd whispered the words. "She doesn't want anyone to see until after she's finished," he said. "But I'll ask if she'll show you one, okay?" He was true to his word, and the next afternoon before she left, I saw Ronnie walking over with a canvas. "What have you got there?" I asked. "Something I did the other day," she said, turning the picture to me. It was the tall cloud I'd seen earlier in the week, the alabaster one. "I thought you painted the future," I said. She smiled. "I painted it on Monday." The cloud had appeared on Tuesday. The paint was dry, but I had no other way of knowing if she was telling the truth. One thing, though, it was a good painting. I'll give her that. "Got anything else?" I asked. She turned away. "There's a few, but they're not finished yet. I don't know why. I'm finding them difficult. It's not usually like that. I went down to the barn in the morning. I felt nervous. It was our barn, though, wasn't it? Why shouldn't I look? There were 6 canvases in a row along the wall, all with their backs facing me. If she was right, all I had to do was turn them, and I'd see the future. I looked over at the house. Inside it, the kids were getting ready for school. Shell would be up and dressed, most likely eating breakfast. Pete would be in the shower, preparing for another day of despair. I walked to the nearest canvas. I actually put my hand on it. By now, my heart was racing. It was the strangest feeling to be worried about this. I went to turn the painting around, but then stopped. I felt I was being watched. I looked behind me. Bridie was there, standing in the doorway, like a bloody Labrador conscience. She was staring at me. I moved my hand away from the canvas and smiled. Bridie just stood there. "Damn dog," I muttered as I walked past her. In the kitchen later, I held my coffee mug between both hands and wondered what I would have seen. I was still standing there when I heard Ronnie's car coming up the drive. Duck, duck, duck. For some reason, all I wanted to do was run up the hill and get on the merry-go-round. But I stayed standing at the sink for much longer than I intended, caught between fear and desire. Bridie was at my feet. She'd been there all morning. A storm is coming, I thought. I don't know where the idea came from, but it did. Every drought must end. At last, eventually, the rains would arrive. That's what it'd be on the canvases. Images of rain and the results of the rain. The growth and changes to come, as well as the destruction wrought. So why couldn't Ronnie finish her paintings? Or was she lying and they were all completed? Was there something on them she didn't want us to see? By April, we were running low on feed, and Pete was making the same decisions as so many of our neighbours. Which of the remaining animals to take to the stales? How much further should we eat into our already depleted savings? Others were taking loans to get them through. Through until what exactly, I wondered. I sat on the merry-go-round, on my spinning vantage point of the disaster unfolding in slow motion below me. The horizon was dust brown. We lived an ecru existence. I wrote that sentence down. The next afternoon I saw more hope. It was in the form of a second column of cumulonimbus. It was thicker and darker than the first. The two clouds hung there, grim reminders, I thought, and equally bright portents. In town there was an atmosphere of expectation. Conversations were livelier than they'd been. Purchases were made more with enjoyment rather than habit or duty. Nothing conscious, though. If you spoke to anyone, they replied in the monotone we'd all used for months. But there was an undercurrent, which I'd first seen from the merry-go-round. I wondered if I was the only one who'd noticed. You have to remember that it's a big sky out there. The horizon was a further journey than it looked. Clouds on the rim take longer to arrive. We knew to wait. Our ticket was hope, but the cost was time. Days passed as the cloud wall drifted closer. The second cloud had been joined by a third and then a fourth. As they sailed slowly towards us, our initial optimism was replaced by frayed tempers. Tightly rolled cigarettes were dropped into the streets, still smouldering. We drank in the morose country pub. Country pubs should not be like that. They don't suit silence. Sometimes, in the night, distant lightning. Were they flashes of excitement, I wondered, or warning beacons? At home, Pete, briefly attentive, had retreated once more into the distance, further than it had ever been. Sue was more sullen than usual. Dale cried too easily. There were complaints about my cooking. They may have been justified. And out in the shed, one afternoon, an argument that arrived as a storm of its own. Storms are formed by many sources. This one, it appeared, was just the inevitable meeting of two unaligned meteorological patterns. I knew Shelby had different expectations to their friendship than Ronnie did. He was kind to her, considerate and caring. But he was too kind, too considerate, and too caring. In the wrong context, these gestures not only go unrewarded, but they're unwanted and can even be seen as intentionally hurtful. The closer he came to her, the further she drew away. A vortex formed from his feelings and her determination to avoid them. And then suddenly, the wind arrived. Doors were slammed, words were said, tears were shed, and farewells were made. She bundled her canvases into her car and drove away. Duck, duck, duck. Only Bridie failed to look concerned as Ronnie rolled down the driveway. A dust trail rose ponderously into the sky behind her, which eventually formed letters and spelled goodbye. We were never to know her future. Shelby became morose. All his hopes for Ronnie had vanished. Perversely, I wondered if his tears might save our dry land. Even Sue showed him kindness. Only Bridie remained uncaring, lolling akimbo on the kitchen floor. I'd nudge her sometimes, hoping to impel some movement into her futile existence. The shed, for that brief while a place of harmony and inspiration, was abandoned. The spiders draped their thick cloths again. Some weeks later, I ventured inside. A few tubes of paint remained, squeezed thin. A cloth lay on the dusty floor, already draped with a layer of dirt that would eventually consume it. But in one corner, facing the wall, there was a canvas. I could see by the splashes of colour along the top that it had been painted on. It wasn't blank. My heart banged inside my chest as I thought of what it might show me. I wondered if I should go over to it, turn it and reveal whatever secret it held. I wondered why this canvas, alone of all the many Ronnie had put into her car that afternoon, she had chosen not to take. I didn't know if Shelby knew about it. It was half concealed in the shadows. What if it was a message for him? Some kind of letter from the future? An image from the past of what was to come tomorrow? In the end, I poked it with my foot and slid it further towards the wall. At night, though, as I lay in bed with Pete tossing fitfully beside me, my thoughts returned to it like it was calling to me. It waited for me, like a window to a different sky. All that happened next is now in the past. I want you to know the context of this account, you see, because the order of events doesn't match the order of my story. One thing that happened was that, inevitably, the drought broke. The thing with droughts is that they always break. The real trick is working out how long you're prepared to wait. For things like droughts, the longer they last, the greater the emotional reward when you finally smell the rain hitting the earth. They should bottle the smell of it. It's that good. I saw Dale and Pete dancing shirtless as the big muddy drop splashed over them. We smiled when we heard the roar of it on the tin roof and saw the deluge of hope flowing into the tanks and streams and aquifers. Normality, which had been held at bay for so long, had at last returned. We'd stuck it out. We'd survived. We'd triumphed. Even Bridie somehow managed to look impressed. Not everyone had made it, but we had. Pete began to build up his herds and sow his crops again. We had bumpy years, but then so did everyone else. And prices went down because there was a glut on the market, but we sold enough. Pete was smiling. Our bank account was growing again. But he still held me in the night and whispered, "Who'd be a farmer?" "You would, you dumb idiot," I said. "But who'd be a farmer's wife?" I thought. Then I'd feel the tingle as he touched me. I'd be a farmer's wife. That's who. Our days turned into nights and back to days again. And one day, in town, Shelby heard something that was new to him. Bridie barking. She yapped insistently at the feet of Melissa Anderson, who was back in town after a stint at uni getting her teacher's degree. Was it really Bridie's premonition? We never knew. Shelby asked her out, and they're married now, of course. I wonder what would have happened if Bridie hadn't been present. Would Shelby have seen her but been too shy to say anything to her? Melissa's a farmer's wife now, like me. She has her job to fall back on, though, or will have, when her maternity leave finishes. I told you the rain wasn't the end of the story. This is the end of the story. It happened before the rain, before Melissa, back when everything was still unknown. It was the afternoon another storm came. Have you ever seen a dust cloud? A wall of brown that puts a curtain across the sky? You see it coming from far away. You know to put the hens away, shut the windows, place damp towels under the doors, and check the children are all present. What you don't do is wait until the last minute to suddenly remember that your little exercise book is in its spot under the merry-go-round where you've recently started to leave it. You don't dash from the house to race the dust to try and retrieve your story before it's blown to infinity. You don't sprint down the drive shouting reassurances to your family. I got there just in time to grab it. But then I looked to the sky. The book was safe, but I wasn't. The wind was howling. The first choking sensation of blown topsoil was hurling itself into my lungs. I did the only thing I could think of. I pushed the merry-go-round and got on. I saw the sky around me darken, the already russet atmosphere now reddening as it consumed the sun. On the merry-go-round, the dust that had been dissolved in the air fell out. I could breathe, like I was in a bubble of pure oxygen. The merry-go-round spun fast that day, more quickly than usual. I crawled to the middle of it. Out on the edge, it was flying at terrific speed. In the center, slow enough for me to hold on. Nothing touched me. The dust stayed clear. I stared into a wall of dry brown air leached from the remains of farms. I didn't care. I knew that I was safe. When the storm stopped, the ground was covered with dust. Trees were covered. The tops of fence posts were covered. Everything except me and the merry-go-round and my book was covered. I walked slowly down to the house, each footfall leaving a silent trail behind me like I was walking through brown snow. I walked past the barn. Inside it was Ronnie's last canvas. She'd said she only painted the future. I had never looked at it. Perhaps in that way I will become immortal, with always a future ahead of me. I went back inside. Pete had organized a game of Uno and I joined in. They were pleased to see me. Only Bridie, of course, showed no concern for my safety. I laughed off my adventure, told them I'd made it back to the barn and sheltered there. The reality of my situation, I felt, warranted the lie. Who wants to hear their mother has been saved by supernatural play equipment? Later we went outside. There were two casualties in the dust. Prince, lying over Charlotte, dead in the dirt under the pepper trees. He came to save her, I thought. He'd come back for her. But it had been too late. We looked at the bodies until it was dark. But even Sue was silent. Despite my earlier efforts to block the doors and windows, dust is a persistent intruder. And it had taken most of the evening for me to clean the house. Our throats were dry, and a thin brown patina sat on the skin of the water inside the glasses I'd put beside the bed. The thinnest layer of topsoil ever, I thought.
Did you get your book?
Pete asked me as we pulled back the quilt. I lay back. I couldn't hear the merry-go-round. Well, did you? He asked. I reached for his hand. Uh-huh, I said. I turned off the light. You shouldn't have gone up there, he whispered. I was fine, I said. And anyway, I've finished my story now.
That was Anne Louise Lambert reading Still Life. It was recorded on the land of the Bundjalung people in the Music Film Studio in Yukai in northern New South Wales. Thanks, Chris and Joe. Trevor Brown composed the theme music. Check out the Ear Movies website for the incidental music details. Please like the show and follow it on whatever platform you're using to listen to it. It'll make a big difference. Ear Movies are written and produced by me, Simon Luckhurst. Thanks for listening. Thank you.